From Vermont Public, this is Brave Little State. I'm Sabine Pooks.
And I'm Elodie Reed.
It's the early 1800s in Hardwick, in the Northeast Kingdom. Settlers have recently secured the charter for the town. People there, specifically men, they're holding an annual meeting to conduct local business. They open mills, schools, a tavern, and a church.
More farms are cropping up, including one on a hillside in the northern part of town, several miles away from Hardwick's southern and eastern village centers.
Parts of this farm sound pretty good, according to newspaper accounts over the years. A writer says it has one of the best cow herds in Hardwick. There's a cellar full of potatoes and vegetables, and the farm delivers milk and cream right into town.
Other parts of this farm sound not so good. The people who live and work here are called inmates, though they haven't committed crimes. They're sometimes treated like inmates, too. There's a large wooden cage where they might be sent if they're acting out. One person reportedly tries to escape multiple times, and another person there kills themselves.
This is the Hardwick Town Farm, also known as the Poor Farm, and it's an important part of Hardwick's response to a 1797 Vermont law. That law says that town shall support, quote, all the poor, lame, blind, sick, and other inhabitants within such town or place who are not able to maintain themselves, and also to provide things like housing and medical care. In other words, the state says it's not their job or the Fed's job to make sure Vermonters have what they need. Rather, it's every town for itself, with each one designating official overseers of the poor to make decisions about the care people receive.
At first, Hardwick takes a more piecemeal approach, arranging for orphans to serve as indentured servants and auctioning off adults and families to other residents who can take care of them at the lowest cost to the town. But by the mid-1800s, the number of people who cannot support themselves has grown. So Hardwick and many other Vermont towns open poor farms and poor houses, where residents are forced to work for their keep, if they're physically able.
As for the care people receive under this system, that appears to vary from town to town, depending on who's in charge. There are stories of meager food and clothing and cruel punishments. There are also a few hopeful examples scattered through the archives, like a story of volunteers celebrating Christmas with those living at the poor farm in Sheldon.
These farms continue into the 20th century. By the time the Great Depression hits in the 1930s, the Hardwick Poor Farm is, quote, not what could be called a paying proposition, according to an old newspaper article. At the 1938 Hardwick Town Meeting, residents decide to close the farm completely. The selectmen sell it to a St. Albans couple for $5,500, equivalent to more than $130,000 today. The quote-unquote inmates who have been living and working there, who are mostly older, go to live with the family of a longtime town official.
At the same time, state and federal governments are taking over welfare services through programs like Social Security. So in the 1960s, Vermont lawmakers approve legislation removing the rights of towns to run poor farms and the responsibility to care for those people who are otherwise unable to, quote, maintain themselves.
These days, in 2024, there's hardly any trace of the poor farm history in a place like Hardwick. The only hint is a steep dirt road, several miles away from downtown, that leads up to a relatively new campus of houses, gardens, and a working farm.
So we were not aware of the poor farm or the town farm, the history of it, until we actually got started.
This history and the potential to learn from it is at the heart of today's winning question from an anonymous listener in Shelburne. What were Vermont's poor farms like? And could parts of the poor farm model of local aid be adapted for the needs of today? And because the poor farm or town farm model functioned at the local level, reporter Elodie Reed also focused her reporting at the local level in Hardwick, where she actually first heard the term poor farm many years ago.
It's where they shut away the people and then they didn't have to deal with them.
And she talked with people in Hardwick about what we might take and leave from that model of care.
I mean, we need emergency housing so bad, and how freaking great would it be if it was on a farm?
We're a proud member of the NPR network. Welcome.
The term poor farm feels pretty outdated in the year 2024, partly because poor in this context is a massive generalization that refers not just to people without much money, but also to people with disabilities, people experiencing mental illness, and people who are older. But this generalization, the poor, is how Vermont justified sending these groups of people to farms in the first place in the 19th and 20th centuries. Poor farm is also a phrase that comes up a lot, like in old newspaper articles and on all the poor farm road street signs you might see around the state. So you'll hear both the terms poor farm and the more palatable town farm in this story. They refer to the same thing. And according to Alan F. Davis,
they weren't very happy places.
Alan is a retired professor of American cultural history who lives in the Northeast Kingdom.
Hardwick's treatment of the poor was still strongly influenced by the English tradition imported into New England in the 17th century.
He's talking about the English poor laws that looked very similar to Vermont's 1797 legislation, and the British almshouses that looked a lot like Vermont's poor farms. By the 1800s, these institutions operated on the idea that poverty among able-bodied people was a personal moral failing, not a societal one.
The town farm was all about the work ethic.
Alan says society back then, and in his opinion today, it divided people experiencing poverty into the, quote, worthy poor and the, quote, unworthy poor. Here he is reading from an article he wrote for the Historical Journal in Greensboro.
The worthy poor were those who were temporarily down on their luck, victims of circumstance, illness, or depression. The unworthy poor lacked character. They were lazy, drunken, or simply unfit. And, of course, in much of the United States, you were unworthy poor by simply being Black or Italian or Catholic.
In Vermont, Alan says, towns tried to only help the quote-unquote worthy poor.
And one way the poor could prove their worthiness was to work on the town farm. But the value of the products produced was not as important as the work done by the poor.
Not only has Alan read about the Hardwick poor farm, he remembers it. Alan is 93 years old and grew up in Hardwick in the 1930s and 40s, right at the tail end of the local town farm. He remembers seeing the farm while his father made a delivery from his general store.
It was remote, but it looked like an ordinary Vermont farm, except there was a fairly big house and my memory of all the old men sitting on the porch. It would be, in a sense, a little like some of the assisted living places we have today for elderly people. But I would urge you not to romanticize the poor farm. I do have this vivid memory of older people saying, I hope I never have to go to the poor farm.
In Hardwick, Alan says there was a certain stigma attached to being a resident at the town farm. But it's hard to glean what life was like for the people who actually lived there.
Are there any photos in there of the farm? Do you know?
I don't think so. And I hadn't noticed that we don't have any pictures of it. But that tells you a lot.
I'm inside the Hardwick Train Depot turned Historical Society with its president, Elizabeth Dow, who also goes by Wiz. There isn't anything about the town farm here on the day I visit. And generally speaking, Wiz says this history remains out of sight.
It's one of those things that's just out there. but not real. You know, it's where they shut away the people and they didn't have to deal with them.
There is one detail about living at the Hardwick Town Farm that we do have from old newspaper archives that I can't get out of my head. And that is the wooden cage. The one where, quote-unquote, inmates went if they were acting out. It sounds, obviously, pretty horrible to me. But Wiz warns me that trying to interpret the past can be fraught.
I wonder about the cage. Yeah, we can look at it and say, oh my God. But did somebody who was having trouble holding it together look at it and say, that's where I'm safe to do what I need to do? I don't know.
What's your sort of ethos around making judgments or not making judgments about like human conditions in the past when you know you're not living there? You don't have all the context.
The past is a foreign country that we can't visit. It's really hard to try to report what happened first accurately and second without judgment.
How you judge the past is so dependent on the life you've lived. And based on the life Forrest Foster has lived, he thinks there's something to be said for how things worked when he was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, when Vermont's last poor farms were closing.
Yep, pull. Bang it. You turn right around and settle on that.
Forrest is a Hardwick dairy farmer. We're in his tractor on the land he's been working for 44 years. It sits on top of a hill just east of where the town farm used to be.
How many acres do you have, Forrest?
135. The house trailers are on my land. Mm-hmm. You see the trees over there in the fence line?
Yep.
Forrest actually grew up in Walden, the town next door. And I haven't found any mention of a poor farm existing in Walden at any point. Not all Vermont towns had one. But each town did have an overseer or overseers of the poor, the officials appointed to manage people's care. And Forrest remembers Walden's overseer with some fondness.
Our lady over there was Gertrude Strong. And you come in and say you broke your boots or it ripped or got a hole in it or whatever. And she'd give you the money for a pair of boots and he'd give you the boots. And then next summer might be planting, might be banking up the house for fall or whatever somebody had been in and said they'd like help with. And it would get passed back to you again, and then somebody needed something again, they worked that way.
What Forrest is describing, it sounds more neighborly than the poor farms I've been reading about. In this scenario, Walden residents who were unable to meet their basic needs still worked for their food, clothing, and shelter, but they did so in their community. The town didn't send them away against their will. Still, this model of local welfare, it really depended on who was in charge. Forrest says Gertrude Strong, the overseer of the poor, had a lot of discretion in her position.
Gertie was an angel to most people. And if she saw you coming in, she didn't think you needed it, or that it really wasn't for you, she would let you know about it right off.
And this leads to the question, who should decide what you do or don't need?
I see a lot of people who feel, with good intentions, that they're arriving at a solution. And often they're not listening to the very people who need the help.
That's when we come back. Down the hill from Forrest Farm, in the center of Hardwick, there's a birthday party happening one evening in early June.
Is it actually your birthday?
It's the Civic's birthday.
The birthday party is not for a person. It's for an organization called the Civic Standard. the Hardwick nonprofit focuses on building community through things like an annual rock, paper, scissors tournament, a theater camp, and a youth-led skate park project. And tonight, it's celebrating its second anniversary at a park in town. Picnic benches dot the grassy space overlooking the Lamoille River. Supper is fish stick tacos, and it's free, just as it is every Wednesday night at the Civics Community Meals.
Like a free meal, for example, is such a simple thing.
This is Rose Friedman, the executive director of the Civic Standard.
And it's so complex because if people... people have a lot of feelings about accepting a free supper. Around like, well, I don't need that, so I should let somebody else have it who might need it more than me. But what we're trying to do is sort of introduce the idea that we don't want to eat separately from each other.
And so I'm here with Rose at the Wednesday supper because I want to know how people in Hardwick think about the town's now defunct farm. And how they might answer the second part of our winning question about how parts of the poor farm model might be adapted for today.
Okay, so I made packets.
Packets?
Just because. Like,
Rose looks over my packet summarizing the Vermont 1797 welfare law and old newspaper clippings about the Hardwick poor farm. She likes the localness of this model. The idea of problems not being solved at the state or federal level, but right here in Hardwick.
It should look a little different probably than it looked, but I mean, we need emergency housing so bad. Like, we need youth transitional housing and a shelter and, you know, emergency housing. And how freaking great would it be if it was on a farm and in a big house rather than a motel?
More people at this community meal agree that it would be pretty nice to have a farm in town where people could go voluntarily if they want housing or work or local food.
That sounds great. I would love to work on a town farm.
Among them, Darren Devine, who likes to go by the name Will. He describes his life as nomadic, and he's spent some time in and out of jail. He says he's in Hardwick for a short time.
When I told you about the question, you said you'd love to work on a farm. What about that would you love?
I don't know. I just love getting in the dirt working on farms. We have little raised bed gardens up in the woods. And then out in the city, I got to bring loads of dirt over to Burlington, to the north end. We've been doing some urban farming up there. So, like, I'm a young man. I can get, like, a lot of, like, hard, heavy lifting workout, but I'm also inconsistent. So I feel like on a farm that a community operates, I could come in and do, like, heavy lifting and moving wheelbarrows of dirt around, but then having, you know, like older people maybe tend to the plants over the months, and then having it provide for the people that need it. And community dinners like this. It would be great if we had community dinners with vegetables that we all grow.
As I make my way around this community dinner, asking people about this poor farm model, what I'm really trying to get at is how people think we should care for each other, and whether we're already doing that well or not, which feel like delicate questions.
Sit down.
You got a cannoli. That's good.
Yeah.
But longtime Hardwick resident and Vietnam vet Bobby Schaefer seems up for it.
Go ahead. I'm ready.
Okay. You're right. With this being recorded.
Oh, yeah. F***ing A. I got nothing to hide.
Okay.
So I just ask.
Do you feel cared for in Hardwick?
Yes, I do. The VA takes care of my physical needs, which is wonderful. And I have friends who drive me to appointments in the community. Gary Smith and the chaplain at the Legion, Todd Manchester. So I hate to ask, but they're very giving.
Do you feel like you have opportunities to care for people as well?
Of course. I give corrective criticism, but, you know, I get a point of view. I've been around. Yeah. So I, psychologically, I try to get people out of their doom and their depression. So I've done that with some neighbors.
It's figuring out this fine line of where to give people space and where to be helpful if possible, you know.
Stella James is the site coordinator at the Hardwick Area Food Pantry, which serves about 100 families a week. She thinks a lot about these questions of care in her community. And so I ask her about the Hardwick Poor Farm.
One thing about this model that struck me is how much of it was decided at town meeting.
Yeah, I was disturbed when I thought about it. I see a lot of people who feel with good intentions that they're arriving at a solution and they want to help figure out how to take care of a quote-unquote a problem, and often they're not listening to the very people who need the help.
Stella says those people with good intentions, they need to trust that the people they're trying to help are experts of their own situations.
I think that people in those situations don't need anyone to solve their problems. What they actually need is someone to notice them and then ask them what they need, and then just provide that thing that they're asking for so that they can maintain their privacy, their dignity, and be able to be independent.
This is something people couldn't do during the Poor Farm era, and something that Stella says people often still can't do in our present-day welfare systems.
And so I see people who, they really want that privacy, so they won't ask for help. And then they end up on the outskirts, where maybe they're like walking through the town and they're seeing everybody doing their jobs and doing the thing, and they just feel more and more distant and more separate from what's going on. And that alienation, I think, accrues over time because those people feel invisible. I feel like we have so much as a society to learn from people who actually have been through those trials. And it's just really sad that we would put them somewhere else because we're missing those opportunities to learn about reality.
And I think that's the basic foundation of Heartbeat and of Camp Hill, that no matter how you're born and which bodies you were born, you have a destiny to fulfill and you have something to bring to the world around you.
This is Jonathan Gilbert, one of the co-founders of Heartbeat Life Sharing. That name, Camp Hill, that he mentions, that's referring to the larger network of communities that Heartbeat belongs to.
And at Heartbeat, we're trying to support each other to discover that. Because we can't actually discover it on our own. We need each other.
Heartbeat is a state-licensed therapeutic residence for people with developmental disabilities where they live with, not apart from, people without disabilities, on a working farm. It also happens to occupy the same property where Hardwick's Town Farm used to be, along Town Farm Road.
It's quite interesting. So we were not aware of the Poor Farm or the Town Farm, the history of it, until we actually got started.
Heartbeat is actually where I first learned about the concept of poor farms some 8 years ago, when I reported another story here. And some similarities persist between past and present. Heartbeat produces milk, cheese, meat, eggs, vegetables, and honey. Some of the people who live in the four houses here also work right on the farm.
Hey, what's your name?
I'm Max.
Max.
Nice to meet you, Max. I'm Elodie. What are you up to out here today?
What are we doing today, Max? Gardening?
Ooh.
Pruning tomatoes.
But unlike the town farm of old, people at Heartbeat get to choose whether they want to live here. They aren't forced to. And everyone gets to choose how they spend their time. Whether that's barn chores or cooking in the kitchen or woodworking or making fiber arts. They also have social opportunities in town, and town can come to them during events at Heartbeat's Community Center. Also, the old terms of overseer and inmate are long gone. Heartbeat's staff are called co-workers, and the residents with disabilities are known on the farm as friends. Among those friends is Anne Blanchard, another co-founder at Heartbeat, and the first resident to move here.
In town, there's a bulletin board where everything, advertisements and ads and so on. And my mom so happened to see an advertisement for Heartbeat.
And she at the time, Anne was living on another community farm for older people, just north of New York City. She liked that at Heartbeat, she could live and work among people with disabilities, people like her.
I have two questions for you. First one is, do you feel cared for here?
Yes, I do feel that I am cared for, and sometimes my needs are met and sometimes not. But that comes just, I guess, natural way.
Right. I'd go through that too.
Yeah.
I guess the other question I had for you is, do you feel like you get to care for your community here?
Yes, I do care for my community.
Can I share some of the things you told me the other day?
Yes.
This is George McWilliam, the executive director of Heartbeat.
When she joined, the families were very young, and Anne did a lot of caring for those young children.
And I helped with the three kids, all in the farmhouse.
I sure hope that we're definitely more current in how we care for each other, you know? There's a real element of being there for one another. And even if this we carry a different title, a long-term coworker and friends, once we really understand the intention of the community, all those titles go away, and we're really there for one another to support each other on development and thrive and help each other in finding what is a purpose in life, you know?
As Jonathan Gilbert reflects on what came before Heartbeat, on Hardwick's poor farm, he says he feels the land chose them, not the other way around.
You might say that land might have some karma, you know? This may be some history that is imprinted into the land, and hopefully there's healing that can be done with the new initiative that come over. And I think that's been the case of what's unfolding here.
Thank you for listening to the show, and a big thanks to the listener in Shelburne who sent in this thoughtful question. To see photos from Elodie's reporting, head to our website, bravelittlestate.org. While you're there, be sure to sign up for the BLS newsletter to stay up to date on new episodes and everything else happening in the BLS universe. We're also on Instagram and Reddit at BraveStateVT. This episode was reported by Elodie Reed and produced by me, Sabine Pooks. Editing and additional production from the rest of the Brave Little State team, Burgess Brown and Josh Crane. Angela Evansy is Brave Little State's executive producer. Our theme music is by Ty Gibbons. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Zoe McDonald, Lexi Krupp, Erica Heilman, Liz Goffrow, Tara Reese, Kent Osborne, Carlotta Hayes, Eric Jonathan, and Jackson Miller. And to all the friends, coworkers, volunteers, and family at Heartbeat Life Sharing. Brave Little State is a production of Vermont Public and a proud member of the NPR network. If you like our show, you can make a gift at bravelittlestate.org/donate or leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back soon with more people-powered Vermont journalism.